about this week's parsha that only when you read through it do you get this appreciation. The Jews are not active participants in the parsha. They're passive. They're sitting on the sidelines, completely unaware of how people are plotting and conspiring to destroy them. So that, I think, gives like a very interesting perspective. It's like, you know, we can sit here and be doing our own thing and completely happy with what we're doing, having, you know, being completely unaware that you have these people that are plotting our destruction sitting someplace. It's also interesting, some of the other background to it, that Bilam and Balak were not people that liked one another personally, and they were not people that got along that much, but what united them together was their hatred of the Jews. So it's also very interesting how we have this ability of bringing peace on earth by virtue of uniting people in a common goal, which I guess is extremely important. Bilam himself is a very elusive character. You read the text about him. Actually, you read most of the Chumash or what the Bible says about him. He doesn't seem to be quite as bad as the rabbis make him out to be. I mean, the rabbis accuse him of every single thing imaginable. Right? You know this. I see that you do know it. They accuse him of bestiality. They accuse him of, all sorts of things. In fact, the rabbis even tell us that anything that you can say bad about him, go ahead and say about him, which itself may seem somewhat strange. I actually am aware of a tradition which goes back at least to the Vilna Gaon that states that sometimes when the rabbis speak about Bilam, who was he? He was a prophet for non-Jews. So sometimes when they speak about him, they're not really speaking about him. They're speaking really about a different prophet for the non-Jews who they felt they couldn't speak about because of censorship, namely about Jesus. So sometimes when you read some of the sources, you have to be a little bit careful.
Is there a marker for that?
I just said the Vilna Gaon. Is that a good marker? It's interesting. There was a book written by a non-Jewish scholar around 90 years ago. His name was R. Travers Herford. He wrote a book called Christianity in the Talmud and Midrash, and he noticed this, and he says it. He didn't say anything about the Vilna Gaon. He noticed it himself, and he talks about it at length. I've seen people bring it down in the name of the Vilna Gaon. Look, just for example, it talks about, he goes, at first he was a prophet, and then he became a soothsayer. Prophet observes, this is what men say, she was a descendant of princes and governors, and played the harlot with carpenters. And you say, now what in the world does that verse have anything to do with Bilam? Or there's an argument, how old was he when he was killed? So it says, I've seen in the Bilam Chronicles that he was 33 years old when he was killed, which also may take it in the same direction. And there is more.
Why did he bring in a lady with a prophet? How did they sort of think that he was actually a prophet?
Well, was he a prophet? No. Meaning the other way around. Was Bilam a prophet?
Yeah. In the sense that he can speak to God.
Well, anybody can speak to God.
He heard God.
Ah, that's something else. Yeah. To hear God is more impressive.
It doesn't define, except the defining of the prophet.
Correct. But the person who, again, if this is a correct saying, then, and again, if this idea is true, so then the rabbis perhaps were searching for a way of speaking about Jesus without saying him by name and without having any sort of a form of censorship, without anybody, you know, really caring what they say about Bilam. There are not that many followers of Bilam around today who are going to get themselves all worked up about it, and therefore they felt they had complete license. I'll say one more point, which may or may not be a strong point. Any of you familiar with the first Mishnah in the last chapter, or sometimes the 10th chapter of Sanhedrin, where it says, all of Israel has a share in the world to come. First line. Next line it says, and these are those who don't have a share in the world to come. So don't get yourself all worked up by the first line, because there are those who can lose it. So then it talks to the people who lost it. And everyone mentioned in that Mishnah is Jewish, except for Bilam. Now, why is Bilam mentioned among the people who no longer have a share in the world to come? If he wasn't Jewish, he didn't have a share in the world to come to begin with. Now, the truth is that is something which we can argue about. Maimonides, the Rambam, doesn't follow the Mishnah here. He follows the Tosefta, which says that non-Jews can also have a share in the world to come. But just in terms of the internal logic of the Mishnah, to say all of Israel have a share in the world to come, the next line, well, Bilam, you know, he lost his. Why would that flow? That mission is not that easy. So again, perhaps one would say that it's not really talking about Bilam. Let's leave that. As I said, Bilam himself is elusive, and if what I'm saying now is correct, then even some of the rabbinic comments about him may also be somewhat difficult to follow. On the one hand, we find literature that compares him with Moshe. That's the famous statement, that there never arose a prophet like Moses among the Jewish people. And then the commentaries jump in and say, yeah, the Medrash ready. Among the Jews, there never rose a prophet like Moses, but among the non-Jews, there was a prophet like Moses, namely Bilam. Now, the simple way of understanding that is to say that the non-Jews would be able to complain and say, it's not fair. God is supposed to be equitable. If the non-Jews would have had a great prophet like Moses, then they too would have followed God's will. And the only thing which held them back was not having a prophet. So therefore, God says, fine, I'll give you somebody on the same level. I'll give you Bilam, and therefore... Do you like that answer, by the way? Because if Bilam was an ineffective prophet, then what does it really help you? There is a very strange comment in the Talmud. It says Moses wrote the entire Bible, entire Chumash, five books of Moses, and he wrote the portion of Bilam. Now, why add that? Why say he also wrote the portion of Bilam? Of course he wrote the portion of Bilam. Like, why would you separate that? So, in what I'm about to say, I may answer that, I may not answer that. But if nothing else, in the book that I was consulting, that was his starting point into the following issue, the book Or Gedalia, or Gedalia Shor, Or Gedalio. So he says the following. I'll embellish it a bit, actually. When God spoke to the prophets, how did he speak to them?
In their sleep.
What else? In their sleep, what else? Generally through images, through visions. When God spoke to Moses, he spoke to Moses by communicating verbally, word for word. The way that this is generally referred to in the literature is God spoke to the other prophets through a prism, and while he spoke to Moses through a direct vision. Now, if he were to speak to the various prophets through a prism, there would be a certain amount of interpretation which would be left to the prophet to interpret. Right? The prophet would use his own words to describe the vision that he saw. So, for example, the Talmud tells us that Isaiah and Ezekiel, Yeshayahu and Yechezkel, both of them saw the exact same thing. Objectively, they saw the same thing. But if you look in Yeshayahu, his vision is two or three lines. You look at Yechezkel, it takes up at least the first chapter and maybe parts of the 10th chapter as well. Which means Yechezkel is completely blown away by his vision, and Yeshayahu just like says it in passing. The Talmud says, why is that? Because Yeshayahu was like a guy who lived in the big city, and Yechezkel was a guy who lived in a small town. Anybody here from New York? No? No one's from New York?
Good group.
Okay, I'm from New York. anybody from like a really small hick town? Where are you from?
South Carolina.
Okay, that's good. So now, can you imagine if you asked two different people to do the same thing, to write about Monday morning, 10 o'clock, 34th Street in Madison, right? In the middle of Manhattan. The guy coming from South Carolina would look at it and say, wow, that's unbelievable. What was going on? All these people moving different places, a guy with green hair, somebody like this, and somebody with two heads. I mean, like unbelievable stuff going on by him, right? All the cars, the noise, the dirt, the homeless. I mean, like, just completely. There are more homeless people in New York than you have people who live in South Carolina. Just something to think about. And the guy who lives in New York, who's asked to describe the same thing, would probably put it like in one or two lines. Typical Monday morning, 10 o'clock. And without giving all that much description, maybe like very, very terse language, a very brief description of what it was. So the Talmud says, yeah, Yeshayahu and Yechezkel saw the exact same thing. But each one comes from his personal perspective and uses his own words to describe it. Now, if that's the case, if Bilam would have been a prophet like all the other prophets, then he would have seen a vision, and he would have had the ability of describing it using his own words. And within prophecy, when you use your words, that is what defines the prophecy. That's what gives it its stamp. So had Bilam done this, then he really could have given something, a very negative twist to it. But let's go a little bit deeper. When Bilam prophesied, what was the main tool that he had? Okay, good. Okay, I guess I'll have to get back to that. What else? What was the tool that he used? He used what the Gemara describes as Ayin Hara, the evil eye. Correct? Now, how does that work? I'm not going to teach you because I don't want you doing this. But what is an evil eye? How does it work? Yeah, you know. God's forced.
God, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
That gets a little difficult.
Well, look.
Okay, maybe. The only problem with that is then why is Joseph unaffected by Ayin Hara?
What?
So let me try to explain, and I'm not going to give you a satisfactory explanation. I'm going to give you the beginning of the explanation. Satisfactory explanation will take too much time, and someone who has more ability than me and more knowledge. First of all, there's two different things in the Talmud. There's one thing which is called Ayin Ra, another thing called Ayin Hara. There's a bad eye, and there's an evil eye. Okay? There's also a good eye. For example, in the second chapter of the Mishnah in Avos, it says, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai asks the students, what are good traits a person should cling to? Rabbi Lezer there says, a good trait is a good eye. A bad trait a person should stay away from, he says, a bad eye. You look at the commentaries there, and they say these are traits. The Mishnah is saying traits. It's not talking about what you would have thought is an Ayin Hara. It's talking about an approach. And I'll even explain exactly what it means, what this trait is. Ayin Ra is to be stingy, is to be small-hearted, is to look at things through really a negative perspective. A person who is really does not like giving of himself to others, that person has Ayin Ra. Let me explain this a little bit better. How do you say tzedakah in English? Well, every Hebrew word has a root to it. What is the root of tzedakah? Tzedek. So the root of tzedek means righteousness. So it's interesting that the English word that we often associate with tzedakah is charity. Charity comes from the Latin, right? Charitas. No? They learn Latin. No? So the meaning of charity is something where you're giving where the other person is completely undeserving, but you're doing it through the grace of your spirit. He doesn't deserve anything. On the other hand, the Jewish idea of tzedakah, again, the Rambam tells us this in the Guide for Perplexed, tzedakah comes from the word righteousness. The Zohar goes so far as to say that tzedakah is tzedek Hashem. That in terms of God's justice, this person who's poor is also deserving food, just like you're deserving food. You are a conduit to help do that which God desires to take place in this world. If that's the case, if I don't feel like giving him, what am I really rejecting? In a sense, I'm rejecting God. So therefore, if I feel that you're undeserving, I'm looking at my giving to you as if it were really charity and not tzedakah. And that whole perspective is a very evil perspective, a very bad perspective for an individual to have. But that is not what we call Ayin Hara. That's Ayin Ra. Right? That doesn't affect the other person. That is a bad trait for me to have. A good trait for me to have is for me really to feel, to work on myself. It's not easy. To work on myself and say, all people are children of God. All people are deserving. You have haves and have-nots. And those that are have to try to help others. And it's a responsibility. I'm a partner with God when I give somebody else food. I am living up to my responsibility. I'm living up to my partnership. I'm simply a tool being used, a kli. I'm a utensil. If a person has that perspective, then they will be able to have Ayin Tov. Okay? By the way, who is the classical individual who had Ayin Tov? Avraham. It tells us in the fifth chapter of Avos. Students of Avraham had Ayin Tov. That makes so much sense, because what was Avraham about? Absolutely, Avraham felt this responsibility of this partnership with God. You with me on this? So what's Ayin Hara then? Ayin Hara is not a trait. Ayin Hara is more of a philosophy. And I want to start on a rational level. I'm not going to get past the rational level. I want to start on a rational level of how an Ayin Hara works. My Ayin Hara is I look at you and I look at you askance. I look at you and I say negative things about you or positive things about you, and you're affected by what I say. That is how I give an Ayin Hara. It's where the individual could be affected. An individual who's not affected by what somebody else says. But by the way, let's take a great rabbi. Should a really great rabbi know exactly what he wants to say and know exactly what message he wants to get across? Or should he play to the crowd? It's a very interesting question. Should a person who really knows his stuff, should he get up and say what he thinks these people need to hear? Or should he be more concerned about the reviews the next day in the newspaper? It's not an easy question, correct? If he's going to analyze it pragmatically and say what will be most effective, that's a good question. Then you're right, then it depends. But if he is going to be swayed and change his own opinions because of the way that people are responding, I mean, he's not firm. He doesn't really know. He's selling out. He's afraid of his contract, and he's afraid of what other people are going to say about him. And what other people, that person does not really, he's susceptible to Ayin Hara. Meaning, the classical individual who's not susceptible, that's Yosef. He knows who he is. Doesn't make a difference that people are trying to move him one way or the other. He has his vision. He keeps to his vision. He doesn't give in to public pressure. He doesn't give in to what other people are saying or doing. That is the classic person who's not susceptible to Ayin Hara. It's not going to work. It's not going to move him one way or the other. By the way, it's not so easy to get to that point. Before you can even get to that point, you have to have a very clear world view. You have to have a very clear hashkafa. Know exactly what you believe in and why you believe in it, and be steadfast. But the individual who's sort of like waving with the wind, whatever people seem to push him one way or the other, that's the person who's susceptible to Ayin Hara. So that I'm saying it on a more rational level. But it's interesting, because Bilam had the ability of using Ayin Hara, of looking into situations, throwing out words, and then causing people to be moved one way or the other, and that was his power of Ayin Hara. Actually, let me ask you a question which is almost rhetorical. Why, if Bilam found that he couldn't curse the Jews, why didn't he just bless the Moabites? You got a tie, right? Jews and the Moabites. He's trying to curse the Jews so the Moabites can win. He can't do it. So why doesn't he just then bless the Moabites? And I'll tell you why. He can't. That's not part of him. That's not part of him. That's not what he's... By the way, the Zohar says this. The Zohar says he's not somebody who can bless. He's only somebody who can curse. He's this cynical, bitter man who can only focus on negative. And by the way, sometimes people like that can really get to you. They can get to you, and they can shake your confidence, shake who you are, and change your self-perception. That's what Bilam can do. Bilam wasn't the sort of guy who was a motivational speaker who's going to get up to the Moabites and say, no, you guys are really great. You can go out to battle. You can do a good job. Wipe out those Jews. Meaning, what the Zohar is saying is that his whole power was Ayin Hara. By the way, maybe, arguably, he had the capacity. You know, you start thinking, maybe Hitler, if he would have used all of his speaking skills to bring people together instead of to speak about racism and world conquest, maybe he could have been unbelievable. But if I would ask you the same question, well, why did Hitler use his power? Because that's what he had, because he was a bitter man who was trying to kill people. Did he have that other capacity? I don't know, but same thing with Bilam. The Zohar says the reality is Bilam couldn't do anything else. That's why he doesn't bless the Moabites. It's not in him. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so now you appreciate again what the rabbis were saying, what I quoted initially. They're saying the truth is that this man was no holy person. He was an evil person. He was connected. His connection came from the other side. There is some wild description of the Zohar, where his power came from, which I'm not going to speak about. I may write about it today still, but I'm not going to speak about it today. And but by saying that he had the same capacity as Moshe, but maybe even his power is a reflection of the pagan world at the time. He is a leader for the pagan, so that his power is coming from the community that he represents. If, and I have to go a little further, if indeed he represents a community. First of all, the first time we meet Bilam in the rabbinic thought is as one of the three advisors to Pharaoh. I don't know if you know this. The rabbis say that Pharaoh had three advisors. One was Bilam, the other was Yisro, and the third was Eov, Job. And Pharaoh consults them and says, what should I do about the Jewish problem? Right? And, you know, I used Hitler before as an example. That was not an accident. What should we do about the Jewish problem? So Bilam says, kill them. Execute them. Kill them all. Yisro says, save them. Yisro caught so much flack for that, he had to run away afterwards. What did Job say? Job said, Job was neutral. Job was Switzerland. Well, of course, how can you be neutral against Nazism? How could you be neutral against genocide? One second, you realize the problem with Job. Job is saying, I don't care. Do what you want to do. No, he was a righteous man. But you know what his definition of righteousness is? His definition of righteousness is somebody who doesn't kill somebody. I didn't kill anybody, so I'm righteous. By the way, this is the major opinion in Western civilization today of a righteous person. Ask the average person, are you a good person? They'll say yes. Why are you a good person? They'll say, because I don't rob, I don't steal, I don't kill. But what good do you do? The whole concept that to be righteous means you have to do good also. Not just sur meira, asay tov. Don't just stay away from evil. You have to do good as well. Job becomes a classic case of the individual who defines himself as being good because he's not doing any bad. It's also fascinating what happens to Job, what he gets sentenced to afterwards. He gets sentenced to incredible personal pain. Why? Because he is so insensitive, he can't feel somebody else's pain, so God says, fine, the only time you'll ever feel pain is if I give you some, so I'm going to give you some. You couldn't begin to figure out that if you wipe out the Jews, you're talking about something which is completely immoral and unethical? He couldn't figure this out for himself? Which is also fascinating if you read the book of Job. At which point does he become healed? I don't know if you've read through the book. At the point that at the end of the book when he starts to pray for his friends. The first time that Job reaches out of his own little world is the time that Job gets healed. Anyway, Bilam is somebody who can, like that, say, wipe out a nation. He's the guy who could be invited now over here. This is not his business. This is not his battle. But Bullock wants to pay him some money, so he's a hired gun, a hired mouth. Actually, the name Bilam really comes from two different words put together. Bili'am, without a nation. He's the ultimate individual. He's a guy who's not associated with anybody. So even him as a leader, as a prophet of a nation, that's why I'm saying there's a little bit of an absurdity over here. He was a great individual, but the way that he looked at it, he doesn't need to associate with other people, because what would a society do? A society would just bring him down. He's the elite. He's the intellectual elite. He's the spiritual elite. What does he need other people for? Bilam is a man who does not form relationships. Yeah. So I'll say it again then. If he really had a great connection with God, he would have had the capacity to bless as well. He did not have that capacity. So according to Zohar, he got it all from negative forces. And actually, he's not the first person to communicate with God. And the level of God that he's communicating with is a lower level. I mean, again, those of you that are familiar with the different names of God used in different places, the name of God that he is connecting with is Elohim, which is a lower level of revelation. So that already you see clearly in the text, again, if you're attuned to that particular point. I accept your questions. I'm just saying that again, the Zohar does insist that he is connecting to this lower level thing. I think it's more of a pragmatic relationship, which is then falls perfectly in line with the way that the pagans related to their deities. It's much more of a pragmatic and not so much of trying to be more elevated. Also, the idea of him getting his visions in his sleep is something which is very interesting, because the way the dreams work in Judaism, I don't know if you've ever heard about dream theory, the way the dreams work is that if you're really bothered by a dream, then you can turn your dream into a self-fulfilling prophecy. If your dream means nothing to you, then it means nothing, which means a dream only has the power of the person who gives it the power afterwards. Which means, in that sense, it's very similar to what I talked about prophecy before. Prophecy is the person has a vision. The word that he gives to it is the meaning it gives. Now we understand, and I don't know if I finished this point before, God speaks directly to Bilaam, unlike the way he speaks to most prophets. Not because he's really equal to Moses on a high level like Moses, but rather, why is he speaking to him like this? Because he doesn't want Bilaam to have any ability of interpreting things in his own particular way. So Bilaam gets word-for-word prophecy just like Moses. So therefore, when it says that Moses writes the books of Moses and the book of Bilaam, even though by Bilaam the words almost literally came out of Bilaam's mouth just like Moses, like when Moses prophesied, and it was a similar level, nonetheless, the prophecy which Bilaam got came to Moses as well. And that's why it's saying that Moses was able to write that book also. So therefore, again, regular prophets see visions, use their words. Moses got words directly from God because he's on a higher level. Bilaam got words directly from God because he was on a lower level, and God did not want him to have an ability of interpreting things through his own jaundiced perspective of the world. Nonetheless, the level is a lower level, and it's not exactly like Moshe. The thing which is similar to Moshe is the words that he's getting and not the vision. That's the issue. He's getting words. But he gets direct words, correct. Yeah, it could be that part of this whole vision of Bilaam is important for the end of days. The fact that the end of days... And first of all, let me say two things about this. One is that Bilaam sees the end of days. That's one thing which is very important. He has a vision of the end of days, which if you want to contrast him with Jacob also sees the end of days, but he loses it. He loses his clairvoyance and he can't say anything about it. Jacob gathers his children together and says, I'm going to tell you now what's going to happen at the end of days, and he can't say anything. On the other hand, Bilaam says, I see him coming, not yet, in the future. I see a star coming out of Jacob. I see the Messiah coming. So Bilaam is connecting with something at the end of days. So maybe that itself is an important thing, to know that at the end of days, the non-Jews will be able to connect. It's going to be a long time between now and then, and that itself even to create that spiritual type of reality. There's another character that's the easiest one to connect Bilaam to, that I think I think had it not been for the rabbis, I think you just read the biblical text, the easiest one to connect him to is Abraham. Correct? Abraham gets up early in the morning and mounts his donkey. Bilaam gets up early in the morning. Although it's interesting, the word in Hebrew that of Abraham's donkey is chamor, and the word in Hebrew for Bilaam's is aton. So what's the difference in aton and a chamor? What? The she-donkey. Well, that itself was... Okay. Bilaam, there's only three people in Tanakh who ride on a chamor. Only three people. Maharal points this out, it's based on the Zohar also. The three people are Avraham, second is Moshe, and the third one is the Messiah. The Zohar says that riding on the chamor is the ability to control the chomer. Chomer means the physicality. Which means Bilaam was not able to control the chomer. Bilaam was directly connected with the chomer. Meaning Bilaam's whole thing there was to make a little money on this thing. He wasn't a spiritual giant. He was a man who was very bright and had certain skills and certain aptitude, but you're not dealing with a spiritual man. Very clear on this. The fact that Bilaam is not riding on the chomer, riding on the chomer. The Messiah is the person who's going to teach us at the end of days how, even though we're in this world where there's a physical and a spiritual reality, how to ride on top of the physical and to reach up to the spiritual. That is the job of the Messiah. Bilaam had nothing to do with that. Bilaam was not riding on a chamar. He was riding on an aton. And again, according to the Talmud, he had a very affectionate relationship with his donkey. Yes, yes. Actually, according to the Zohar, all of the visions he would get at night would come to the donkey first.
And the donkey would then tell him what was going on. Yes, okay. Now, there's one other biblical character who's connected with Bilaam, who you never would have guessed it necessarily, although there is a certain linguistic connection, and that person is Lavan. Lavan is also an individual who God, Elohim, speaks to at night. And you could have asked the same question there. Why should Elohim come to Lavan at night? Why does Lavan deserve to have some sort of revelation from God? Same question come up there. If you read the Targum Yonasan on the very beginning of this parsha, it says when the first time Bilaam is mentioned in the Chumash, Targum says, his name is Lavan Ha'arami. Bilaam is Lavan. There are some sources that say he's a grandson of Lavan. Some say he's a reincarnation. Some say both. You can guess which ones say which. Bilaam and Lavan. Now, what's the connection? So what's the connection between Bilaam and Lavan? Anybody remember the Passover Haggadah? Remember where Lavan makes his way into the Haggadah? Good, good. It says Paro, one second, it says Paro only tried to kill the males. Lavan, on the other hand, wanted to kill everybody. Exactly when was that? When do you remember seeing Lavan going around killing everybody? So you could perhaps try to argue that when he chases them down, he tried to kill everybody. The only problem is that it doesn't say it. It doesn't say he tried to kill. He said he chased them down, and what he says is, what his words say, is, you know, excuse me, how do you go running off like that? I wanted to say goodbye and kiss you goodbye. I would have made you a big party if I would have known you were leaving. There is one phrase where he says, and even your God came to me in a dream, and he said, I can do with you what I want. But, I mean, are we really accusing that Lavan would have killed his own daughters and his own grandchildren? In fact, from the text, you get quite the opposite. Because what does he say in almost the next phrase? He says, these daughters are my daughters. These children are my children. This cattle is my cattle. Lavan gets up and he says that all these things are mine. In fact, if you begin to listen to Lavan, Lavan doesn't at all sound like a person who's vengeful or full of, you know, wants to go murdering people. And that's the key, by the way. Lavan doesn't want to kill them. It then never said in the Haggadah that Lavan wanted to kill them. What did it say in the Lavan? It says, Paro wanted to kill the males. Lavan bikesh la'akor es hakol. What does the akor mean? Lavan wanted to uproot everything. Lavan, it doesn't say wanted to kill the Jewish people. He said he wanted to uproot it. When you uproot something, when something's beginning to grow, you uproot it. You don't let it plant. You don't let the roots go down. You don't let it grow. What did Lavan try to do? What did Lavan want to happen? What was it that? No. Read right over here in the text. This is what it connects to. What was it that Lavan wanted? Lavan never wanted Yaakov to leave him. Why? Because from the day that Yaakov showed up in Lavan's house, Lavan was incredibly successful. From the day that he showed up, what Lavan wanted was Yaakov to stay and keep on working with him, make a lot of money, and to live happily ever after. What was the? By the way, this is very contemporary. What was the terrible threat of Lavan? Assimilation. If Yaakov stays behind and lives with Lavan, he never goes back to Israel. If Yaakov never goes back to Israel, the Jewish people never come into existence. If they never come into existence, they're completely uprooted before they ever sprout any of their roots. That's what? Exactly. And if all 12 sons stay back by Lavan and assimilate into the community, it's over. That was the insidiousness of Lavan. By the way, this gives us a little bit more insight. Bilaam, who is this reincarnation of types of Lavan, he, in the beginning, he wants to wipe out everybody, which is, again, in line with this first way that you would understand Lavan. And what does he suggest at the end? At the end he says, okay, if you can't beat them, then join them. If we have no ability of destroying the Jewish people from outside, so the way to beat them then is to intermarry with them, which means send all the girls up and try to seduce them. Exactly what Lavan's major claim was, what he would have loved to happen for the Jews to stay together, complete assimilation, that is what Bilaam ends up getting to. I think there may be maybe even a deeper idea over here. So you mentioned before about that Bilam knew exactly how to figure out that one moment of the day where God gets angry. Did anyone understand that? Why does God get angry for 1 hour of the day? What's that all about? Judgment. But why? Because too much good and too much kindness is not good. What is the Torah's example of too much kindness? Anybody know? Incest. Kindness, right? Where it talks about incest between a brother and sister, the Torah says chesed hu. That's a place of too much chesed, too much kindness, too much love, too much giving. Which means even kindness has to have a limit. So if you go, now you work backwards a second. God is not going to have complete chesed. He holds back. Now, let's work it this way. And he has one moment of anger, as it were, not to have an over amount of kindness. Bilam normally will focus into that moment of anger and then try to manipulate it. God does not show any anger on that day. So therefore, if there's no anger at all, whatsoever, then what do you have? You have too much kindness. You have too much kindness. What does that lead to? It leads to illicit sexual relations. So therefore, the result of what Bilam ends up doing is based upon that same idea. Ah, there's no anger at all, so then he moves in with this extreme amount of extreme amount of kindness. Excuse me?
That Rashi says, yeah, that for those few weeks, that God's trait wasn't there. So at that point, those 2 weeks, then...
they become susceptible. Right. And that's why then they become susceptible to this sort of behavior. Let me just go back to a different mod. They become susceptible. Exactly. That's exactly the point. That's exactly the point. That's why. Because Bilam is trying to move in there with his Ayin Hara sort of thing. The Jews are going to be judged. Or the way that some of you wanted to understand Ayin Hara. Ayin Hara is when you throw something out at somebody, then the judgment comes in. The judgment comes in, so guy's going to be found guilty, and people will be affected by the words that he says. God has no judgment during that time. No judgment at all, and there's too much kindness. Too much kindness, what follows? Illicit sexual relations. And that's what Bilam ends up going into. But let's just go back to a model that I mentioned earlier. What, do you see that? Okay, exactly. Let's go back to a model that I said earlier. Abraham... what was his students? Ayin Tov, a good heart. Which means what Bilam ends up doing is looking at the encampment and saying, this is really beautiful. You have people living together as a community. By the way, this is something he doesn't understand at all. Why? Because he's Bilam, Bilam. He's a guy who doesn't form relationships. He's looking at the Jewish people living together as a community. And instead, what does he come up with? He understands, again, he's Ayin Ra. He's looking, and where does this ability to live together as a community come from? It comes from Avram, Ayin Tov. So what does he then suggest? Okay, send more people to enter into the community. Which means he realizes that the weakness of the Jews is going to be their kindness. And therefore he says, start sending the girls into the community, and they'll embrace them. Which means, and again, there is this negative side of chesed. According to the Kabbalists, the one who most closely manipulated this particular idea was Yishmael. I've spoken of this in the past, that Yishmael, it tells us, is a counterfeit of the idea of chesed. Yishmael, the Medrash tells us, used to run around trying to seduce women. And he would say, didn't your follower of Avraham? They would say, yeah. Didn't Avraham teach that chesed is the most important thing? They would say, yeah. So he'd say, so you should sleep with me. Again, that's not chesed. That's the difference between love your neighbor as yourself and loving your neighbor's spouse as yourself. Or difference between love versus making love. What Yishmael tried to do is, again, to take the idea of chesed and to twist it. This misanthrope, which is really what Bilam is, he's looking at the Jewish community. He comes to this conclusion that he has no ability of throwing at them this Ayin Hara. He's got no ability of twisting them around. So what does he do? He sees the beautiful way that they're kind and that they're noble and that they're friendly and they take people in. So he goes back and says, okay, you're not going to get them through evil. What you got to do is get them through love. And that was the plot which he ends up with. But what I'm telling you then is once you understand that this was the plot, you realize that it really comes all the way back from Lavan. Because that's what Lavan was about. Lavan was about assimilation. what we have to remember every time we confront a loved one, and it's logical, it makes sense, loved one also indicates logic, if you've heard me speak about that before, what we have to remember is that there's something else, that there's another issue. It's not just kindness. We are on a mission. We're on a mission, we're on a march toward destiny. The Jewish people were encamped in the plains of Moab on the way to their destiny. When you're on the way to your destiny, it's not necessarily the best time to start fraternizing, and it's not necessarily the best time to start having the types of meetings which they did. And sometimes that's very difficult, because once you're in a mindset, you're in a mode of a Torah mode, of a mode of giving, and you feel that ayin tov, that you have to give to others and help others, sometimes the knowledge about where you draw the line, what is an appropriate type of giving, and to whom is appropriate type, and the time to do it, and when to do it, and how to do it, that's not so easy. And by the way, that's the real reason why just giving by oneself without having any sort of Torah perspective is very dangerous, ultimately, because it can lead you in all sorts of places. Over here, again, that's the sad part of this story, is that Bilam is unable to attack them because he can't give them this ayin hara, but what he does do is he attacks their goodness, and he ends up manipulating that.